Last week we talked, left off talking about how Satan was bound by Christ at his resurrection, and he, being bound, he can deceive the nations no more, and that was the what his binding was specifically done for, that he could not keep the Gentiles in darkness anymore, but the gospel went forth to all nations. And then we also looked at, and which I will elaborate a little bit on today, how being bound, he's not entirely immobilized, but still has liberty to go out and tempt the saints and things like that. And what I want to look at today is the length of the binding of Satan. So we want to see how long this is going to last. And this is going to take up a significant part of the epic war between God and Satan. Satan will be bound for the lion's share of it. If you turn to Revelation 20, verses 2 and 7, we're told there that Satan was bound 1,000 years. Revelation 2, 7 and 20. It says, "And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent called the which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. And then in verse 7, it says, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison." So the 1,000 years, since it is in the book of Revelation, doesn't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily be taken literally, at least without looking at what else the Bible says, because the book of Revelation is a little bit different than the rest of the books of the New Testament in that it is a prophetic book, and it is said to be signified. In the very first verse of the book, in Revelation 1 and verse 1, for us to just take 1,000 years and just say that literally means 1,000 years, would be to not interpret the book in the way that it says that it's written in the very first book, the very first verse of that book. Revelation 1 and verse 1, it says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John." He signified it. To signify means to be a sign or symbol of, to represent, betoken, or mean. So if something is signified, it is put in signs and symbols. It is allegorical, in other words. So it's not to be necessarily taken literally. And there's nothing wrong with interpreting the Bible in a figurative sense whenever the Bible itself or this book specifically says that it's given in signs and symbols. So if it's given in signs and symbols, and for you to take a literal interpretation of those signs and symbols is going to make you be messed up. Satan's not actually a lizard, right? He doesn't actually look like, you know, he's not actually a dragon. Jesus isn't actually a woolly creature called a lamb and so on, right? So you don't always take things literal when they are clearly written in a symbolic fashion. And this is one of those instances. So just the fact that the book of Revelation is signified, we know that we are not to necessarily take the 1,000 years literally. They could be, maybe, but we wouldn't. That would not be our default position. So if we go elsewhere in the Bible and we look at the word or the number 1,000, that might give us an idea of how that word is used in the Bible, and that's indeed what we should do. So let's go over to Psalm 50 in verse 10, and then I have a couple other ones after that. We're just going to look at some usages of the word 1,000 in the Bible and see if it is used in a literal sense or if it's used in a figurative sense. Psalm 50 and verse 10. What we're going to find here is that the word 1,000 is used in the Bible figuratively to refer to a large and complete number of something. And I'm going to show you three verses that will prove this. So first of all, Psalm 50 and verse 10 says, "For every beast of the forest is mine," this is the Lord speaking, "and the cattle upon 1,000 hills. So God says that he owns every beast of the forest and he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Now, there are a lot more than 1,000 hills in this world. There's probably 1,000 hills in Ray County. I don't know, probably. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. I don't think there's a straight or a flat road in this entire county, for sure. So there are a lot of hills out there. But the Lord owns more than just the cattle in Ray County. He owns the cattle on every hill, right? This is just a way, a symbolic, figurative, poetic way of saying that the Lord owns all the cattle. Because 1,000 hills is a bunch, and that's just saying that God owns them all. Right, just like he owns every beast of the forest, right? Every beast of the forest would be compared with the cattle on 1,000 hills. So he doesn't own just a few beasts of the forest. He doesn't own just a few cattle on a few hills. He owns all of them on every hill. Let me give you another example. Psalm 105 and verse 8. Psalm 105 and verse 8. And by the way, I love the fact that there are no straight roads or flat roads in this place, because coming from Minnesota, where it looks like you're living in western Kansas or something, it was incredibly boring. So I'm from Pennsylvania, and I like hills and curves and all that, so I'm happy with it. Anyway, Psalm 105 and verse 8. Psalm 105 and verse 8 says, "He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations." So here it says that God's covenant, his word, is commanded to a thousand generations. Now, for one thing, if you just added up the generations that have been around in mankind, I don't think you're going to get to a thousand anyway. There was only 42 from Abraham. Was it from Abraham? It was from Abraham to Christ. There were only 42 generations. I think we read about that. Let me just make sure that. I think that's in Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. In verse 17, "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations." 14 times 3, 42. 42 generations from Abraham to Christ, and that spanned a period of time of about, I think, 2,000 years or so. So that's a third of world history right there, and that's only 42 generations. So, you know, go figure, 120-some generations maybe in world history or something to that effect. So there haven't been nearly 1,000 generations, and I'm not sure that we're going to live, you know, here another 60,000 years to make it to 1,000. So anyway, you get the point there, that when he says he commanded to 1,000 generations, he's just saying, I commanded it to all the generations, right? Big, incomplete, large number, not necessarily a literal 1,000 there. Let's look at one more, First Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 16, 15 through 17. 1 Chronicles 16, which is basically a parallel text with that portion of Psalm 105. 1 Chronicles 16, 15 through 17. It says, "Be ye mindful always of his covenant, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, even of the covenant which he made with Abraham, and of his oath unto Isaac, and hath confirmed the same to Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant." Now here you have 1,000 generations compared with an everlasting covenant, that it would be something that wouldn't end, right? So a large number representing a large, incomplete amount of time. That covenant was first given to Abraham, then through Isaac, then it was written down in the law of Moses to Jacob for an everlasting covenant, and it was fulfilled by Jesus Christ, and specifically by his resurrection. Let me just give you this one just for fun. Go over to Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55. I think this is pretty neat. Isaiah 55 in verse 3. It says, "Incline your ear and come unto me, hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David." So when you see the word even there, even is defining what was said before it. So an everlasting covenant is the sure mercies of David. Now let me show you something else. Turn over to Acts 13. Acts 13, and then let's start reading at verse 32. Acts 13, 32. Remember that Isaiah passage. You might want to keep your finger there. Everlasting covenant is the sure mercies of David. Acts 13, 32. "And we declare unto you glad tidings, how that the promise which was made unto the fathers, God hath fulfilled the same unto us their children, in that he hath raised up Jesus again, as it is also written in the second psalm, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And as concerning that he raised up him," or that he raised him up from the dead, "now no more to return to corruption, he said on this wise, and I will give you the sure mercies of David." You see that? sure mercies of David equals the everlasting covenant. The resurrection of Jesus Christ was the fulfillment of the everlasting covenant that God made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That was the promise. To Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith, not into seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. The promise was always the promise of Christ. Okay, so anyway, there's three examples of how the word 1,000 is not used in a literal sense. It's used in a figurative sense, representing a large, complete number of something, right? An indefinite number. Now, either the 1,000 years in which the devil is bound, or the 1,000 years in which Christ reigns as king, or both of them are not literal. So I've showed you by comparative scripture that it would be very reasonable for us to conclude that the 1,000 years is figurative, based on other language, similar language used in the scripture. But now I want to show you from Revelation 20 itself that the 1,000 years can't be literal. So let's turn back to Revelation chapter 20 and verse 2. I'll show you something from the text itself. Now, I guess I couldn't prove that both of them are not literal, but I can absolutely prove that one of these 1,000-year periods are not literal, because there are 2,000-year periods given in here. There's 1,000 years when Christ reigns, and then there's 1,000 years when the devil's bound. We already looked at the devil being bound there in verse 2, 1,000 years. But then look at verses 4 and 6, and this is Christ reigning 1,000 years. It says, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. And then verse 6, "Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So here you have Christ reigning for 1,000 years and the devil being bound for 1,000 years, but these 1,000 years are not the same period of time. And I will show you that. So you have two main belief systems when it comes to end times. You have amillennialism and you have premillennialism. You also have postmillennialism. That's not nearly as popular. So amillennialism is what we believe, and that's the belief that the millennium, the 1,000-year period, is the period where Christ reigns from his resurrection until the end of time at his second coming. So basically from the first coming of Christ to the second coming of Christ, that's the millennium, the 1,000-year period. It's not a literal period of time. And then you have premillennialism, which says that Christ will come back after this tribulation that's going to happen, and then he'll put down the armies of the earth that the devil has put together to fight against the saints, and then he will set up this kingdom on earth for 1,000 literal years, and then afterwards, I guess he comes back a third or fourth time and destroys the whole thing and creates a new heaven and a new earth. So premillennialism, meaning pre-Christ comes before the millennium. Okay, so but in both of these systems, the 1,000 years can't be, or one of the 1,000 years anyway, can't be literal, and I will show you how that is. Postmillennialism, just to, for completeness, they teach that through the preaching of the gospel, the culture is going to be reformed to the point where it's pretty much entirely Christian, and then that's going to usher in the millennium, and you're going to have 1,000-year millennium, and then Christ comes back at the end of that 1,000-year millennium. That's closer to what we, not definitely not what we believe, but closer than what we believe than the premillennial scheme is. And then, of course, you have preterism, which says that it was all over 70 AD, and we're in the new heaven, in the new earth now. So it's great, isn't it? I love it. So anyway, I'm just going to look at premillennialism and amillennialism, or amillennialism, or now millennialism, as one guy calls it. And I like that better, actually, because that kind of tells us that we're in the millennium now. It defines what we mean by that. Because amillennialism technically is a pejorative, I think that would be the word I'm looking for, term that the enemies of it came up with to say that you don't believe in a millennium. A meaning no millennium. When you put an A in front of something, like it negates it. Like an atheist is somebody who's not a theist, right? He doesn't believe in God. So anyway, we do believe in a millennium. We just don't believe in a literal 1,000-year millennium. We believe in a figurative 1,000-year millennium. So anyway, and we believe, I guess we believe in a literal reign of Christ. We just don't believe that the period of time is a literal 1,000 years. We do believe in a literal reign of Christ. He's reigning right now. Anyway, so let's move on. So with both belief systems, this must be the case, that one of these periods of time are figurative. So in the amillennial belief system, the 1,000-year reign of Christ is the period between his resurrection and his second coming. And the 1,000 years in which Satan is bound is the period between Christ's resurrection and a little season before the second coming. Okay? So let me say it again. In the amillennial system, the 1,000 years is from Christ's resurrection to his second coming. In the amillennial system, then the binding of Satan is the 1,000-year binding of Satan is from the resurrection of Christ until a little season before the second coming. So you see, those two periods can't be the same length of time. They're both called 1,000 years, but one of them is 1,000 years minus a little season, right? So they both can't be 1,000 years. Either one or both of them have to be a figurative period of time. And that little season there is given there in verse 3, Revelation 23. It says, "And cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season." So it's called 1,000 years, and then a little season after it, but that 1,000 years plus a little season fits into the 1,000 years that Christ reigns, which happens, you know, which begins at the same time and ends after the little season. So let me just give you an example. This is probably clear enough, but let me just say, I'll give you a not a real time period, but I want to give you a time period just to make this make sense. So let's say we know that Christ was resurrected 33 AD, and let's say he came back and destroyed the heavens and the earth and everything in 1933. I don't want to use a future date because I don't want anybody to think that I'm even coming close to setting dates or predicting anything, which I'm not. So let's just say it was 33 to 1933 for ease of calculation here. So that is 1900 years, right? So the millennium, right, the 1,000 years in that case would actually have been 1900 years. Now let's say Satan was loosed a little season before that. Maybe he was loosed in 1833. Okay, so that would be 100 years before that. Okay, so the 1,000 years that Satan was bound would have been 1800 years plus a little season of 100 years to get up to 1933 when Christ came back and destroyed the earth. Okay. So in that case, and that would make sense, a little season, 100 years compared to 1,800 would be a little season, I would think. So in that case, they're both said to be 1,000 years, but one of them is 1,900 years, and one of them is 1,800 years. Neither of them are 1,000 years in that case. But even if you wanted to say, okay, maybe one of them was literal, or they can't be literal, but let's just say in an alternate universe, Christ comes back in 1033, okay? And probably a lot of people thought that he was coming back around that time, because if they read this, these verses and didn't bother to compare scripture, and they say 1,000 years, and they think, oh, well, it's been 1,000 years, maybe he's coming back. So let's say he came back in 1033, Satan was loosed in 933. So Christ was reigning for 1,000 years, in that case a literal 1,000 years. Satan's loosed a little season before that, 933, but he's only been bound 900 years, right? So it's still, they can't be the same period of time. Now, in the premillennial system, and this is what most people believe, the 1,000 years of the reign of Christ, it still can't be, both of those 1,000-year periods still can't be literal. Because in that system, the 1,000-year reign of Christ is from the time Christ returns after the tribulation and puts down the kingdom of the Antichrist and binds Satan until the end of the world, because it says that Christ must reign until he puts all enemies under his feet. And that's 1 Corinthians 15, 25, and 26. The last enemy is death, it says. Well, then death is going to be cast into the lake of fire at the last day. So in that system, Christ has to reign for 1,000 years from the time he comes back and puts down the devil's reign there until the end of time, right, until the last day. In that system, the 1,000 years which Satan is bound would be the period from the beginning of Christ's reign until a little season before the end of Christ's reign on earth, when the devil would be loose for the little season and then cast into the lake of fire at the end of time, along with hell and death. So therefore, the 1,000 years of Satan's binding and the 1,000 years of Christ's reign cannot both be the same period of time, and therefore they can't both be literal. Because in one, the premillennialists say that Christ literally, or he's here a literal 1,000 years, but yet Satan is bound for only up until a little season before the end of that literal 1,000 years. Right? So Satan is not bound the same period of time that Christ reigns, because he's loosed for a little season towards the end of it. So in either system, they can't both be literal. Now, I would say if they're not literal, or if one of them is not literally 1,000 years, what would make you think the other one is literally 1,000 years? If it's been proven that at least one of them definitely is not. If one of them's not, then chances are both of them is not. And of course, in our belief system, it's certainly not. Neither of them are literal. And the reason for that is, of course, the thousand-year reign of Christ is not literal, because he's still reigning now, and it's been almost 2,000 years. And the reign of the binding of the devil can't be a literal 1,000 years, because if it was a literal 1,000 years, that means that he's been loosed for almost another 1,000 years. And I can't think that 1,000 years can be considered a little season when compared to 1,000 years, right? It's the same amount of time. So if he's bound for 1,000 years and loosed for 1,000 years, it can hardly be said a little season, right? So that doesn't make any sense. So Jesus binds Satan, and he casts him into a bottomless pit, and he shuts him up and sets a seal upon him when he bound him. Let's look at Revelation 20 and verse 3, which I already read just a minute ago. I'll read it to you again to refresh your memory. And cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. So he's shut up in the bottomless pit. And the bottomless pit is hell. It is elsewhere described as a great furnace in Revelation 9 and verse 2. So Satan is thrown into hell and shut up with a seal upon him, to where he can't deceive the nations anymore, can't keep the Gentiles in darkness anymore like he had. Revelation 9 and verse 2 says, and he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. So this bottomless pit is filled full of fire and smoke like a great furnace. Kind of sounds like hell to me, right? It's called the midst of darkness, and it is said that the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, says in Revelation. It's also called the place of eternal fire. So the bottomless pit here is clearly speaking of hell. And the bottomless pit is a prison for the devil. Look at Revelation 20 and verse 7. Revelation 20 and verse 7. It says, and when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. So Satan is in prison down in hell in the bottomless pit for this figurative thousand-year period. The bottomless pit is likely in the center of the earth, and the reason for that is that if you were to manage to dig down to the center of the earth, you would be at a place where gravity would be neutralized in every direction, right? So there would be no gravitational pull on you if you were at the exact center. You would be at the center of gravity, so to speak, and it would be like being in a bottomless pit, because you'd just be there floating. You wouldn't be pulled in either direction. You wouldn't be pulled down or up, so you would be in a bottomless pit. That makes sense to me anyway. Now, Satan is called the angel or the king of the bottomless pit. If you look in Revelation 9 and verse 11, this all kind of fits together, that Satan, that Jesus bound him and cast him into the bottomless pit, and Satan is elsewhere called the angel or the king of it. So that makes sense. Revelation 9 and verse 11, it says, and they had a king over them. This is the locusts, I believe, that John is seeing here. It says, and they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. If you remember way back, long time ago, probably, I don't know, nine months ago, I don't remember when we first started this series, we went through the names of Satan, and two of those names were Abaddon and Apollyon. Apollyon, they both mean the same thing, but I have the definition here of Apollyon. It is the destroyer, the name given to the devil. And it says there that they had a king over them who's the angel of the bottomless pit. Now, we know that Satan is an angel, right? And I can prove that to you with 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14. Just to show you that this is talking about Satan. Makes sense. He's bound there in the bottomless pit, and he has dominion over it. What a kingdom, huh? 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14. It says, "And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light." He was the anointed cherub that covereth. It was said there in the book of Ezekiel. And a cherub is an angel. So Satan was an angel. He was an angel of light. He fell and became a creature of darkness. But he can still transform himself into an angel of light. He can look like a good guy. Now Satan will be manifest in the beast which shall ascend out of the bottomless pit to make war with God's two witnesses and with the saints. Let's look at that in Revelation 11 and verse 7. So this beast that will arise out of the bottomless pit, this beast, of course, is going to be the embodiment of Satan. This is going to be Satan's creature, and I don't mean a physical creature, but a political creature, what exactly, a governmental creature, whatever this beast is going to be. He's going to be inspired by Satan. We'll get to that later on in this study as well. But in Revelation 11 and verse 7, it says, "And when they shall have finished their testimony," this is the two witnesses, "the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them." So this beast comes from where Satan is, from the bottomless pit, right? He's inspired. It is inspired by Satan. In Revelation 17 and verse 8, Revelation 17:8 describes this beast again. It says, "The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they shall behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is." Was, is not, and yet is. That sounds kind of strange. Like he was and he's not, but yet he still is. And I'm not sure exactly I can tell you what that means with regards to the beast, but it's interesting that the beast comes from the same place the devil is, and we can see in a sense how the devil was and is not and yet is. Because the devil was, he was in control of this world, right? He had it all. He said to Jesus, he'd give him all the kingdoms of the world, right? He had it all. He was the God of this world, still called the God of this world. And he is not, because he was destroyed and spoiled by Jesus and his doom is sealed, so he is not officially. It says in Hebrews 2:12 that Jesus destroyed him that had the power of death, that is the devil, right? So he was destroyed and he was spoiled. Remember Colossians 2:14 and 15 that he I hate it whenever I can't get it started. It says that he spoiled principalities and powers, but I can't get how the verse starts. Colossians 2:14 and 15, "Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross, and having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it." So Jesus destroyed and spoiled Satan, so you could say that he is not, right? He was, he is not, because he has been destroyed, and yet he is, because he still has power to tempt the saints. So he's still around, he just doesn't have the power that he used to. 1 Peter 5, 8 and 9, we see that Satan still is. He's still around even after he's been cast into the bottomless pit. 1 Peter 5, 8 and 9. It says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. Whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world." So Satan was and is not and yet is. He's still around. And he will be loosed at the end of time, as we see there in Revelation 20, to make war with the saints again. So he was and is not, and yet he still is. Revelation 20, 7 through 9. "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea." And then they went up on the breadth of the earth, and passed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven, or from God out of heaven, and devoured them. So, was, is not, and yet is. And then eventually he's going to be not again forever in the lake of fire, which will be good. So anyway, it's just interesting that the beast ascends out of the bottomless pit, and the beast was and is not and yet is, and Satan is from the bottomless pit and inspires that beast, and he was and is not and yet is. Just thought that was kind of interesting. Okay, now let's look at the effect of the binding of Satan. And I mentioned this last time. The effect of it is that he is bound so that he can deceive the nations no more, as he had for the 4,000 years prior to the gospel going out to all nations. So he can't deceive the nations, right? He's bound, so he has no power to keep all the Gentiles in darkness like he had before. But he still has power to tempt and to destroy the saints individually. And I just read that verse there in 1 Peter 5, 8, and 9, and I won't read it again. But remember, resist the devil. He walketh about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So he's still able to mess with us individually. But how can he do that if he's bound in the bottomless pit? Well, you remember Paul. I gave the example of Paul being bound and yet having liberty. Remember that? And Paul could still receive his friends while he was bound. If you look in Acts 24, 23, and 27, there's a really good, interesting parallel here. One is good, one is bad, and I mean, they're totally opposite in some ways, but I think this illustrates the point pretty well. In Acts 24, 23, and 27, Acts 24, 23, and 27. It says, "And he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and let him have liberty, that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister or come unto him." So Paul here is bound, but yet has liberty. He's able to have his friends come to him. And in verse 27 there it says he's bound. "But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound." So that state in which he was in, where he had liberty, and his friends could come to him, that was still considered being bound. He was still in prison. And yet Paul was very effective in a positive way in the lives of the saints while he was in prison. Look at 2 Timothy 2 and verse 9. In fact, so effective was he that much of the Bible that we have right now was written by Paul when he was in prison, the prison epistles. Philippians, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Timothy, I think. At least 2 Timothy was written when he was in prison. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 9. Paul says, "Wherein I suffer trouble as an evildoer, even unto bonds." That is bonds, like, you know, when they put on your hands when you're chained down in prison. "But the word of God is not bound." See, Paul was bound. Paul was in prison. Paul didn't have liberty to do whatever he wanted. But you know what? He wrote scripture. He wrote letters that ended up being circulated across the entire world for the next 2,000 years and are the inspired scriptures of God. He has had more effect than probably any other man except for Jesus Christ in human history, and he did so from a jail cell. So Satan can have a lot of effect from a jail cell, just like Paul had a lot of effect from a jail cell. There was a man way back when, he was put in prison for violating the Alien and Sedition Acts that John Adams instituted back in the early 1800s, the second president. And I think it was this guy, I'm pretty sure, and he was actually elected some type of office, congressman or something. He was elected to office while he was in prison because people were so outraged at what happened to him that he got elected to high office when in prison. So I guess you could serve your term there and still do something while you're in prison. The devil likewise still has access to his friends, through whom he's still effectual in a negative way in the lives of the saints while he's bound in prison. Because remember, Revelation 20 and verse 7 says that the devil would be loosed out of his prison. So he's in prison too, just like Paul was. And just like Paul had a good effect on the saints, Satan can have a negative effect on the saints through his friends, through his devils that he can dispatch out there to terrorize us. Now, the devil's not omnipresent like God. He can't be everywhere all at one time. So even if he wasn't bound, he still couldn't be everywhere at one time. He can't be tempting every child of God there is at the same time himself. But like I said, he's got plenty of subordinate devils that can do his bidding. And we have some examples of this in the Bible, you know, not examples of this specific thing, but an example that we can compare it with. Like, for instance, when Jesus was said to have baptized many people, actually, Jesus never baptized anybody himself. It was his disciples that did the baptizing, and yet Jesus was given the credit for it. In John 3 and verse 22, just to show you an example of how Satan can be said to walk about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour and tempting the saints, and yet Satan doesn't have to be doing it himself personally. He can be doing it through one of his subordinates. John 3:22. After these things came Jesus and his disciples into the land of Judea, and there he tarried with them and baptized. So that verse says that Jesus baptized. Jesus tarried with his disciples and baptized. But yet in John 4 and verse 2, we're told, let me just read verse 1 to get the context. When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, parentheses, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples. You see, Jesus didn't actually dip anybody in the water by himself, but they were doing it in his name, by his authority, in his stead, and it was said that Jesus had baptized the disciples. Right? And there's nothing wrong with that. It's called federal headship. Likewise, it was said that Solomon offered 22,000 oxen and, what was it, 120,000 sheep on the altar there in Jerusalem. Now, if you, and I haven't done the math, but if you just do some math there, if you offer 142,000 animals, and even if it took you, and it would take you a while to do that, right? I mean, you just slay yourself a sheep or a cow or something and cut that thing up and offer it on an altar, even if you could do it in 10 minutes, well, that's a long time. I mean, we're talking probably years. I wish I should have done the math ahead of time. But anyway, a long, long time. Obviously, Solomon did not do this by himself. He did it through the priests that God had instituted to do these sacrifices. 1 Kings 8:63. I'll just give you the verse which says that Solomon did this. 1 Kings 8 and verse 63. It says, and Solomon offered a sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered unto the Lord, 22,000 oxen, and 120,000 sheep, so the king and all the children of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord. So it was said that Solomon did it, but clearly it was the priest that had done it. Solomon couldn't have even done it anyway, legally. You're not allowed to offer a sacrifice. Saul lost the kingdom for offering a sacrifice. But Solomon was said to have done it because he's the head of the nation. Just like somebody can say, hey, Trump spent $1.3 trillion last year. Well, Trump didn't spend it. The federal government spent it, but he's at the head, so you say Trump spent it, right? Or Trump's bombing all these people over there. Trump's doing this, Trump's doing that. Trump's not doing hardly anything, but, you know, people that he's directing or whatever are doing stuff. Same idea. So Satan can be said to be tempting the saints when it's really his minions that are carrying it out on his behalf. Okay, so the next part of this great war, then, is Satan goes after the early church. Because all of Satan's attempts had failed to prevent the Messiah from coming and from bruising his head. And we spent weeks talking about that, how Satan, just one person after another, just kept focusing the battle on the next descendant that would be the heir to Christ. And he was never able to stop him from coming. He wasn't able to kill him when he early tried anyway. And then once he was able to succeed in killing the Messiah, then God raised him from the dead and defeated him. God won the battle right then and there. And then once Jesus Christ was raised from the dead and sat on his throne in heaven, then the devil turns his attention to persecuting the disciples. Because once Jesus is in heaven, and remember, after the second war, Satan's cast out of heaven. He has no place there anymore, right? He didn't prevail, and their place is found in heaven no more. Satan couldn't even get to heaven to persecute Christ himself if he wanted to. Not that he'd be able to anyway. So he then turns his attention to Jesus' disciples, to people like you and me. And this is where the rest of the war, the majority of the rest of the war, is going to be fought against Christ's disciples. Because before Christ left, he had promised that the gates of hell would not prevail against his church. If you look over in Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus said, Matthew 16 and verse 18, "And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." So Jesus makes this promise that he's going to build his church, and Satan is not going to be able to defeat it. Jesus goes up to heaven where Satan has no more access to him at all. Where do you suppose Satan's going to focus his attention? Well, I don't know. If I were Satan, I would say, well, he promised that the gates of hell wouldn't prevail against this. We'll see about that. We'll see about that. I'm going to make the gates of hell prevail against this thing. If I can't destroy Christ, I'll at least destroy this little fledgling church that he started and eradicate it from the earth. And that's exactly what Satan goes out to do. Before I continue there, something was dawned on me this past week at a Bible study that I attended, and I just thought I'd share this with you. The next verse, Jesus says there to Peter, "And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven." And then it was said that the door of faith was open to the Gentiles. Paul talked about how when he gave the news and they were glorying that God had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles in the end of Acts 14. And Peter was the one that first went to the Gentiles, to the house of Cornelius, and preached the gospel to the Gentiles. So the door of faith was opened to the Gentiles by Peter. And Jesus said that he'd give him the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And Peter takes the key and opens the door of faith to the Gentile. I thought that was pretty cool. Anyway, it just kind of dawned on me. Well, I think the pastor said something that was quite close to that. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I'd never thought about that before. So anyway, I thought I would share that with you. I don't know when the next time I get a chance to do so would be. Okay, so anyway, Jesus says he's going to build his church. The gates of hell won't prevail against it. So if Satan goes after Christ's church, this would be tantamount to persecuting Christ himself, because if he can show Christ to be a liar or something, to show Christ to be impotent and not able to protect his church, then he's won. Or if he can just harm Christ's people, then he has harmed Christ himself. And this is what Jesus taught in Matthew 25, 44 through 45, that if somebody does something to Jesus' saints, they have in effect done it to him, whether good or evil. If you do something good for your brethren, you've done it for Christ. And if you do something evil to your brethren, you've done it against Christ. Matthew 25, 44 through 45 says, this is Jesus speaking here. He's talking about the last day, the great white throne judgment. And he's now to the folks on his left hand, to the goats. And he says, "Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or a thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, insomuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me." So Jesus says, I was in prison and you didn't visit me. I was sick, you didn't visit me. I was naked, you didn't clothe me. I was a stranger and you didn't take me in. I was thirsty, you didn't give me any drink. And they say, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? I don't remember not giving you anything. And he says, you didn't do it to the least of these, my brethren, and therefore you didn't do it unto me. So if Satan can harm the brethren of Christ, he can harm Christ, because if he persecutes them, he has persecuted Christ. And I'll prove it to you. Look at Acts 9, 1 through 4. "I will prove to you that persecuting the saints of God is persecuting Jesus Christ." That's why the other day some guy, he saw me down in Kansas whenever I met that Baptist preacher Stephen Anderson down there. And this guy, I don't know if he recognized me or what, but anyway, he found a video of mine and then apparently remembered that he saw me down there or something anyway. And he didn't like what I was saying about sovereign grace, and he asked me some things about sovereign grace, I guess just to confirm what a heretic I was. And when I gave him the defense of it, which is unusual, I normally don't even respond to people anymore, but whenever I gave him the defense of it, then he said that He had seen me, and he knows where Excelsior Springs is because he lives on the other side of Kansas there, or in other side of Kansas City, and he says that he will make sure to tell everybody he can in the Kansas City area about me and what a heretic I am, and to steer clear of me. And you know what I said? Thank you. Please do. I would be happy if you would do that. Because when you do that, when Christ's church is persecuted, then Christ comes to defend it, and you read the book of Acts, and the more they were persecuted, the more it grew. So please, please do. I hope you do. Acts chapter 9 and verses 1 through 4. And Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went out unto the high priest and desired of him letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. See, he's persecuting the saints of Christ, right? And as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined round about him a light from heaven. And he fell to the earth and heard a voice saying unto him, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Jesus is speaking to Saul. He says, Saul, why are you persecuting me? But who was Saul persecuting? He was persecuting Christians, the saints, right? He wasn't actually going up to heaven to persecute Jesus himself. But Jesus says, you have persecuted me because you persecuted my people, which makes perfect sense because his people and his church are called his body. So if you persecute his body, you have persecuted him. So this is what Satan is going to do. He's going to go after the church, which is a way to persecute Christ. So the church is going to be the new battleground for Satan. Now, after Satan is cast down to the earth and then into the bottomless pit, he knows he's only got a short time, and he was full of wrath because of this. Look at Revelation 12 and verse 12. Revelation 12, 12. This will be the last section for today. Revelation 12, 12. This is right after that second war in heaven. And it says, therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. He didn't have much time left, and he's going to make the most of whatever he has. So he's full of wrath, and he's really going to focus his energies on persecuting the church. Verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast under the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. Remember, I told you a week or two ago that the woman that brought forth the man-child that was to rule all nations with a rod of iron was caught up to God and to his throne, that woman was the church. It was began with Israel, the people of God, and that's where Christ came. He came through the nation of Israel, and then the nation of Israel was reformed. The church in the wilderness of Israel was reformed into the New Testament church. So Satan, when he goes after the woman, he's going after the church. And remember what Jesus said, where they said unto him, thy mother and thy brethren wait to see thee. And he says, who is my mother? Who is my brethren? But they that keep the commandments of God and do them. So words to those effect. Jesus says, my mother is my disciples who keep God's commandments, right? The woman is the church here. And the dragon, when he was cast out to the earth, persecuted the woman, which brought forth the man-child. He persecuted the church. Verse 17, and the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The seed of the woman in this case, the woman's descendants, the woman brought forth Christ, the Jewish church brought forth Christ, and their descendants are us, right? And we are they who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That is a definition of a local church, right? We keep God's commandments and we have the testimony. We have the Bible and we live to keep God's commandments. And that's who the dragon goes after, the woman and her seed. Now, throughout Satan's persecution, the Lord protected the church from the devil's assaults. Revelation 12 and verse 14. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And throughout history, we can see this happening, where God would send his people, like the Waldenses and the Albigenses and some of those, he would send them off into the mountains, and they would hide up in the mountains, and be protected from the face of the serpent. And then, of course, with the American experiment, when the Lord allowed his people to come here to this land and have a place of refuge for a long time from the face of the serpent, I believe this could be examples of, especially over here, given the wings of a great eagle, she flies over, or sails over, or whatever, but anyway, goes across the seas and ends up in this land far away where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. So God gave his people reprieve where he allowed them to escape the assaults and persecution of the devil throughout time. Some of them were allowed to be killed, but they remained faithful unto the death. Look in Revelation 12 and verse 11. It says, "And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death." Some of God's children will live a good long life and die of old age. Some of them will be martyred for the faith, and many of them have been in ages past. Some of them still are today, and who knows, that may come back again. But you know, the thing is, it says there that they overcame him, they overcame the devil by the blood of the Lamb, by their salvation in Christ, and by the word of their testimony. And they loved not their lives until the death. They weren't defeated whenever their lives were taken from them. They weren't defeated by being martyred. They won by being martyred. They overcame the devil by being martyred and remaining faithful until the end. I love that. And then what's going to follow in the next sermons, I'm not sure how many, is going to be examples of Satan's persecution of the saints. And we're going to start with the apostles, and then we're going to work our way down and just show biblically all of the saints that Satan persecuted systematically, trying to eradicate the church from the face of the earth, ultimately persecuting Christ.